From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. As the Arctic temperatures have closed many area schools and businesses for the second day in a row, we get suggestions on how to protect domestic animals. Later below zero temperatures and a thick blanket of snow have deer turning to their survival skills to find food.
If the snow is deep enough and they can't necessarily get to that, sometimes they have to be a little more innovative about where they find their food. And yes, that could end up bringing them into more urban areas if the food is available.
Essayist Richard Hederman revels in the silence of a spiritual retreat. And your doctor should be both competent and empathetic.
There's no reason to settle for a doctor who's an excellent technician but has poor communication or relating skills. There are enough doctors out there who possess both that we shouldn't have to settle for someone with a bedside manner that rivals a roll of surgical tape.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The extreme cold warnings have been dire. Limit outdoor exposure or risk frostbite in only a few minutes. And if you've ventured outside at all during the past couple of days, you know just how quickly the cold and the wind will cut through just about anything you're wearing. But these warnings aren't just for humans. Wisconsin Humane Society Executive Director Ann Reed says it should extend to our pets as well. She joined Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce over the phone to talk about how to protect pets from the risks of this current weather.
The dangerous frostbite is the main one. It's a significant danger for humans, and it's a significant danger for animals for the same reason. A very short time exposed to air and especially to ground this cold can be very harmful.
Obviously, Fido's got to do his business. So how exactly do you navigate that challenge when the weather is this cold and a short time of exposure can be really harmful?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing is it's okay to keep your animal indoors as much as possible. So if your dog is used to a long walk and you feel bad about cutting that short, don't feel bad. Really, just long enough to do what needs to be done and get back inside is just fine. It'll be warmer again by the end of the week, so it's not going to be a long time. Your cats should be indoors during this time, even if they normally go out. We advocate for not letting cats out generally, but especially now, whatever your normal habit is with your cat should be indoors during this time.
What kind of protection, what kind of steps can we take to protect our animals if we do need to bring them outside for that short period of time?
One of the biggest pieces of protection that you don't normally think of as protecting from cold is a leash. If you're not used to having your dog on a leash, most people walk their dog on a leash in urban areas, but many don't. And this is a situation where even if your dog is really reliable and is going to walk right next to you, if something happens, this is not the day you want that to happen. So a leash, even if you don't normally use one. A coat, even if you don't normally use one. I have to say this winter is my first winter for a dog coat. And then my dog will now, if I'm ready to go out without it, will kind of look at the coat and look back at me. He wants that coat on. They sell boots that your dog can wear. Different dogs have different levels of tolerance for putting those on, but if your dog will tolerate them, actually the paw pads are among the most susceptible areas, so definitely consider those. And all of that will help, especially when you're starting from the idea that this is going to be as short a time outside as we can have.
Even for, you know, a dog like a husky, do they need a coat?
Sure. We're hearing a lot about, actually, we're getting so many questions about this today. And some people are saying, you know, my husky, my Malamute wants to go outside. You know, certainly not every dog has to have a coat. If you don't have a coat for your dog, whether it's a husky or a chihuahua, don't feel like you can't go outside until you get one. Just keep that walk short. And certainly let your dog be your guide. There are dogs who are built for colder weather, and then a coat might be less of a priority purchase for you.
Well, so if you have a dog or even a cat that's used to going outside and taking a long walk, how do you keep that animal from going stir crazy?
Sure. You know, even though it's going to be a fairly short cold spell, dogs especially need exercise, as we know. And so there are lots of ways to do that indoors. There's the classic throwing a ball and getting back. Somebody just posted on our Facebook page that they're going up and down their stairs with their dog, just getting their dog a little bit of exercise that way. There are lots of toys out there, some of which you can buy, some of which you can make. If you Google something like putting treats in a muffin tin and covering them up a little bit and having the dog find them, sort of brain toys that will keep your dog's brain occupied, if not body. If you and your dog are home today, lots of fun things to Google on sort of activities to do indoors with your dog.
So when we're taking our pets outside to do their business for that very short period of time, you've mentioned taking the cue from the dog. Are there behaviors that they're going to demonstrate to show us they're absolutely ready to go in, even if they maybe haven't done what you came out to do, if you will?
Every dog is different, but a couple of key things. One is it's pretty easy to notice if a dog's paws are in pain. They'll start especially lifting maybe one paw up or trying not to put any paws down, almost like a little bit of a dance. And a lot of dogs just won't want to go with you. They'll start pulling back toward the house. You may find yourself in a situation where it will take several very short trips outside to get done what you used to get done in one. But especially watch for those paws on the ground and a sense of whether the paws themselves are in discomfort.
What should we do if we see another animal out?
A dog or cat outdoors today or tomorrow is in danger, and what we are recommending that people do for companion animals is to call that non-emergency number, whatever is the non-emergency number in your neighborhood, unless you feel like it is a truly life-threatening situation, in which case we are recommending that people call 911. We're also getting some questions where people have in their neighborhood cats especially who are always outside all the time. And is there some way that they can provide some sort of shelter for that cat if they don't want to call about it? And again, the internet really is a terrific source of ways to provide sort of warm or shelter for an animal that you know is outside, whether it's a cat or a raccoon. Straw and styrofoam coolers and things like that can make some great shelters for animals outdoors now, but not for your typically home animal. That animal should be indoors right now.
And that goes for dogs that you would typically keep outside, an outdoor dog?
Absolutely. Your outdoor dog should come in. There's no question about it. This is a really dangerous time, both for people and for animals, to be out.
Well, Ann Reed, thank you so much.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Ann Reed is the executive director of the Wisconsin Humane Society. We heard her talk to Stephanie Lecce about how to protect your companion animal and how to help other pets found outdoors during this cold snap. One tip Reed gave was to keep your dog on a leash. No one wants their pet to get away during such harsh weather, but it does happen, and it is no reason to give up hope if it does. Lost Dogs of Wisconsin director Kathy Poblosky says animals find ways of keeping warm, and she tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce how she and the volunteers at Lost Dogs counsel the owners of lost dogs during extreme weather.
We try to share stories of successes that we've had in the past. One of the most notable was a small dog, a Chihuahua, that was missing for 4 months during the winter about 3 years ago. It was a very cold winter, and she survived just fine. And she was lost in November, and we caught her in March, and she had actually no physical problems whatsoever. So when we have an owner that's really concerned, we'll try to send them a link to some of our success stories where the dogs have survived. But we also like to, you know, always tell people that it's cold. Definitely it's cold. But a dog that is lost and is not being pursued or chased will make very wise decisions and will find places to hunker down. There are many, many places that people might not be aware of that a dog can get into for warmth. And I would much rather that the dog be allowed to do that than people really be panicking about this very cold weather and being out there pursuing a lost dog or pressuring it, and then the chance that it's going to run into traffic and get hit by a car is very, very high. So when left to their own devices, dogs are very, very resourceful.
What are some of the strategies that dogs instinctually use to survive such cold weather?
They will burrow. One of the things, they will burrow into mulch piles or, you know, around the foundations of, they'll get under a deck and burrow right up against a foundation of a house. They will find places, like if you put your hand, a lot of industrial buildings or even, you know, retail places or whatever, have large landscape lights that shine up onto the building at night. And if you put your hand onto those landscape lights, you can you will burn your hand practically. If those are shining into any sort of evergreen shrubbery, that makes a really warm little kind of hidey hole that a lot of rabbits and things like that will use as well. So a lot of the places where rabbits will go, the dogs will go. They will even burrow down. We've found them burrow down into rabbit holes when it's really cold, that they've been using places like that. Evergreen shrubbery is a really good one. But if they can get anywhere where that shrubbery is against a foundation or near some lights or something like that, that's a good place that they will hunker down in for during the period of time that it's really cold. And they will tend to not come out to try to eat on these really cold days. They will stay hunkered down. And their metabolism is fine. They can, you know, they'll be fine for a day or two. And then as soon as the temperature starts to warm up, they'll come back out again searching for food.
With those kinds of behaviors in mind, does that change the advice that you're giving to pet owners whose pets have gone missing?
Well, what we would typically say on a day like today is you're not going to go out and see your dog somewhere. It's going to be hunkered down somewhere. So today is a good day to spend flyering, distributing flyers to people that may see your dog on Wednesday when your dog comes out, you know, when it warms up a bit and the dog comes out and is looking for something to eat. So do things today that don't involve physically searching for your dog because you don't want to chase your dog today out of the place that it's hunkered down in. So a good day, you know, today is to get online, read articles about missing pets and what they do, get onto our website, and also, you know, get online, post your flyer in as many places as you possibly can in the event that when your dog does come out to look for food on as soon as the weather warms up, that you've got that flyer and that information out there. It's kind of like looking for a needle in a haystack when you just kind of aimlessly go out and try to drive around looking for your dog, because the chance that you're going to see your dog on a day like today is pretty much slim to none. The other thing, there's so many abandoned buildings, people that leave their garages open a little bit, maybe because they're letting, you know, cats in and out or something like that, that dogs will often take advantage of those sorts of things too, abandoned barns, sheds, things like that, where they will get in and get enough shelter to survive the cold weather.
You mentioned it's unlikely that we'll see lost dogs out and about in this kind of weather. But if you do happen to see one, or perhaps one has taken shelter in your barn or in your garage that you've left open for the cat, what do you do if you find what appears to be a lost dog?
Well, the best thing to do is to not make eye contact with the dog and to try to get down below the eye level of the dog, which, of course, you know, with a small dog, that's pretty low to the ground, and I don't know that we want anybody laying on the ground on a day like today. But on a nice day, that's what we would suggest, is get down on the ground, don't look at the dog, and if you have little bits of tasty treats, like little bits of hot dog or whatever with you, slowly, you know, toss them out and see if you can lure the dog closer to you. But again, you want to be really careful. Our whole goal is to make the dog feel comfortable and relax into an area. Anytime you put pressure on them and you start to, you know, pursue them, or, and when I say pressure, it can even be just reaching your hand out to grab their collar. That might send that dog fleeing again, and all of the hard work that you've done to try to, you know, help that dog relax and feel safe might be undone really quickly. So if the dog is coming into your garage, of course, you can put some blankets and some nice smelly food there for them. And if you can, close the garage door without them sneaking out again, that would be great. You know, and then try to find the owner and let them know that you have their dog. But again, the whole thing is to let these dogs settle into an area, relax, and then they return to a more domesticated state of mind. And dogs that are not being pressured or not in panic mode make very wise decisions. When dogs are they're panicking, when they're being pursued, they make very poor decisions. That's when they will get hit by a car.
Well, Kathy Pobleski, thank you so much for giving us some tips.
Well, thank you for having me.
Kathy Pobleski is director and co-founder of Lost Dogs of Wisconsin, an all-volunteer group that helps owners reunite with their lost dogs. She's also director of the animal welfare advocacy group Wisconsin Voters for Companion Animals. Well, it's not just domesticated animals that feel the effects of extreme temperatures. Coming up next, we'll hear from the Department of Natural Resources about how wildlife is faring when Lake Effect returns in just a moment. You're listening to WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thank you. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about the effects that the frigid temperatures have on domestic animals and the precautions pet owners are advised to take in such extreme weather. But there are many animals in Wisconsin that don't have the option to come inside from the cold. Wisconsin wildlife is outside all of the time, but how well adapted are wild animals to conditions with snow, ice, and temperatures falling below negative 20 Fahrenheit? Diane Robinson says more so than you might imagine. Robinson is the Milwaukee County wildlife biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about how wildlife in Wisconsin is adapted to deal with winter, at least an extremely cold one like we're experiencing.
It depends. The animals that you're going to be seeing right now are adapted to the cold. The animals, there's a lot of songbirds and things of that nature that are not as well adapted to Wisconsin winters. And those animals are currently farther south. A lot of the songbirds migrate down to Texas, Mexico, South America, as far down as they can get. So the ones that you're seeing in your yard right about now are, you know, relatively well adapted, but there's also a fair number of Wisconsin animals that have already hitched a ride out of Wisconsin.
Well, and if I remember my bird knowledge accurately, Canada geese fly as far south as it takes to find open water. We sometimes see Canada geese in our area in the winter, but is it safe to say that most of them have left Wisconsin behind this January?
Yeah, geese are kind of, so I guess we should start with the fact that there's a couple of different forms of migration. There, like I said, a lot of smaller birds, hummingbirds, for example, migrate very far south. Then there's some other animals, geese, red-tailed hawks. You see red-tailed hawks out there now. Hawks do migrate, but they don't necessarily migrate as far south. So like you had said, there's a fair number of waterfowl, ducks that you'll see out on the lake, geese, things of that nature. Some of them that you see could be residents that stay in the Milwaukee area or stay in Wisconsin all year round, whereas some of them have migrated from places farther north, and this is the furthest south that they've gotten.
What about mammals? You know, we all know about certain mammals who hibernate over the course of the winter, but what are the ones that stay active?
Well, so, again, on the migration standpoint, there are some mammals that migrate kind of in that they're moving a little bit farther south. They're moving to a slightly different area. There's a lot of squirrels out there. They're not as active today and this week when it's extremely cold out. They are more likely holed up in dens and whatnot, just trying to stay warm, keep their body temperature relatively low so they're not using as much energy. But once it warms up, you know, a little bit warmer, a little bit closer to 32 degrees, they'll probably be out and about looking for some food and trying to stockpile that energy all over again. So mammals, as a general rule, have to deal with it. That being said, they've got some really good insulation. You look at raccoons, you look at squirrels, and they generally put on an extra layer of fur during the winter months. And they also are out there eating as much as possible during fall so that they have that energy available during the winter.
What about cold-blooded animals? There was a fair amount of discussion on the DNR's Facebook page this weekend about turtles, which apparently don't have any complaints about frigid weather. Is it true that turtles will swim quite happily underneath a thick sheet of ice?
Yes. So, you know, it ultimately depends on the amount of open water available. Turtles require air. So if there is open water that they can get their heads out and get some air during the winter, and if there's also enough open water that they can swim around and get some food, there's no real major reason why they wouldn't be relatively active, probably at a slightly decreased rate just because it's a little bit colder and being cold-blooded, they move a little bit slower. But as long as there's air and there's food, they would do relatively well.
And frankly, we're all moving a little bit slower right now.
Yes, exactly. They're still swimming around in there. They've got food. They've got plant matter in the lake, and there's, you know, still fish that are swimming around as well, so they can get their energy and still move around throughout the winter.
Well, and you mentioned fish, and obviously fish are active through the winter because people know that ice fishing is a really popular activity during Wisconsin winters. How is the fish's food supply affected? You know, I remember learning that, you know, there are fish that eat insects. What is there for fish to eat when so much of the lakes and streams might be frozen, or at least the insects have retreated?
Well, there's still smaller things, smaller invertebrates that are swimming around in the lake, and they can eat that during the winter. There's also organic matter down on the, you know, on the bottom of the lake that they can get to, and that provides energy. It ultimately just depends on the fish species that we're talking about as to, you know, the different food that they have available to them. But yeah, there's still food out there. Again, the ice freezes on the top because it's cold, but when you get down in the lower depths where the ice hasn't gotten to, it's still, I mean, the ice kind of provides an insulating layer, same as the snow, on top of the ice provides an insulating layer that kind of helps to keep the water above freezing at least. So it gives them a little more opportunity to get some of those food items.
When it is so cold and there is so much snow, are there increases in the number of animals that will go into areas inhabited by people in search of food?
If it gets cold enough, I think most animals are probably going to hunker down. Right now, when it's, you know, a wind chill of negative 30 or whatever it is at this present time, it will definitely, most of the animals are going to just stay in one spot and stay warm in that one spot. Ultimately, winter, the hardest part about winter is trying to find food. There isn't a whole lot of food available to them in the winter. With more snow cover, some animals have it a lot more difficult to find. You know, deer will browse on twigs and things like that, but if the snow is deep enough and they can't necessarily get to that, sometimes they have to be a little more innovative about where they find their food. And yes, that could end up bringing them into more urban areas if the food is available. However, if it's cold enough, they would probably do better just staying in one spot and just trying to conserve that energy rather than going out and trying to find extra energy when it's so difficult to find energy during the winter.
You are a biologist. Is there much research, much work that the DNR does on animals at this time of year?
Well, so this week is actually our winter waterfowl surveys. So we fly planes over open areas of water to count how many waterfowl species and individuals are in that area. There's also some deer aerial surveys that have been going on over the Christmas break. And, you know, it depends a lot on what animals you're working with. So, again, birds, not so much. But there is a fair amount of research that's done on deer to see how they do in the winter. There's research that's done on other mammals that may be a little more active during the winter. And so you can, this is a really good time for tracking. And you can do that even whether you're with the DNR or you're an individual. You can go out with a fresh snow on the ground and see how many different tracks you can see just in your backyard. And you can ID the species that are in your area just based on those tracks. So DNR individually, I don't think we do as much research in the winter. However, there's plenty of other organizations that do a lot of research. And the winter is a little bit slower, but there's still things that you can look at with depending on the species.
I would imagine the amateur trackers among us might want to wait until it's warmed up just a little bit.
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
Diane Robinson, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Diane Robinson is Milwaukee County Wildlife Biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and she's the Education Director for the DNR for the Milwaukee region. She talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke from the DNR's Waukesha Service Center. The sounds of wildlife are among the few things Richard Hedeman will hear during his yearly spiritual retreat at a Trappist monastery. And as his essay, The Longitudes of Silence, makes clear, that's exactly the point.
Sprawling across an open hilltop and surrounded by 1,800 acres of woodlands and fields outside Spencer, Massachusetts, very nearly the exact geographic center of the state, is St. Joseph's Abbey, a complex of fieldstone buildings comprising a monastery with a chapel, bell tower, cloister and retreat house, and approximately 80 Trappist monks. It is deeply rooted in their tradition for Trappists to offer refuge to travelers, and each year I return and spend a week with them in January, the true geographic center of winter. The Trappists are a Catholic religious community of cloistered monastics, a branch of the Benedictines formerly known as the Order of Cistercians of the Strict Observance. Deeply contemplative by rule and by practice, the order has emerged over the centuries as the standard for Western monasticism. St. Joseph's was settled in 1950 by a group of Belgian and French monks from Nova Scotia and Rhode Island. In these rustic hills of central Massachusetts, the monks cleared the land and built their monastery themselves by hand with the guidance of local contractors. Trappists rigorously follow a way of life that is at once faithful to the archaic traditions of the order and likewise adaptive to modern life. Though cloistered, the monks of St. Joseph's keep up with the news. They read the papers, listen to the radio, and many of them have email accounts. At least some among them appear to be sports fans. I once saw an elderly monk removing a Yankees cap before donning his robes for Vespers, and this in Red Sox country. Historically, most of my fellow retreatants at St. Joseph's have been clerics of one class or another, priests and monsignors, and once by some odd chance, a Baptist preacher from North Carolina. Above all, I'm there for the silence. And I imagine the devout regarding me with suspicion as I bundle out the door in hiking boots for my morning hike down the hill to the main road and back, or spend an evening in the retreat house parlor under a lamp with my feet up reading a murder mystery. Except for meals, one's time at the Abbey is almost entirely unstructured. There are essentially only two rules: don't make any noise, and never tread unaccompanied into the monastic enclosure, that part of the monastery and its grounds forbidden to guests. Securing permission for a foray alone into the monastic enclosure is nearly impossible unless you can confirm absolutely that you are retreating from a grass fire. After the midday meal, the broad, revenant swale of afternoon is before us. One drifts wordlessly across the longitudes of silence. The retreat house and its inhabitants fall into a tranquil, contemplative torpor. As I quietly read in the deep afternoon light or invite sleep, the sky above our hilltop often stages dramatic expositions of weather. Winter winds rarely blow gently here, but howl, hammering windows and rooftops and roaring like the breath of God shoved through a needle. Gusts of heavy rain or billowing snow and violent lashings of wind scour the hilltop, hurling enormous volumes of towering cloud. In the spellbound dusks, veils of snow unfurl and lay upon the hills like a leaf from the gospel. At 5:30 each evening, a brother leads us to Vespers, a word sounding deliciously like whispers, and deriving from the Latin for evening. We follow a winding path through the monastery complex, down a labyrinth of passageways, padding solemnly over polished stone floors, gleaming softly in the medieval light. There are vistas through a series of soaring arched windows of an inner courtyard deep in snow, and snowbound statues of the Virgin and others too rimed with ice to recognize. Contrary to common belief, it is Compline and not Vespers that is the final service of the monastic day. The word Compline derives from the Latin root meaning complete, and of all the services in the divine office, it is my favorite. The chapel is dimmed to the light of a single candle suspended from the nave. Monks in pale robes chant. The chapel is submerged in unbroken shadow, consuming the fires of day and assuaging the soul of the mystic, the penitent, and the uncertain. One night, as I lay drifting off, a pack of coyotes yipped and howled somewhere beyond the walls of the retreat house as they ranged the moonlit fields in utter disregard of the monastic enclosure. So feral and unrestrained was their exclamation that hair rose on the back of my neck, and I dared not look out. for what I heard had in it something beyond us, a savage lament for the undefined terrain of the spirit, or perhaps just some primal salute to the unknowable.
Poet and essayist Richard Hederman lives in Wauwatosa, and while he hopes to return to St. Joseph's Abbey soon, this January he'll be listening for the feral and unrestrained howl of winter from the solitude of his study. Coming up next, can you teach a new doctor how to have empathy for her patients? And does it matter what the doctor feels? Well, we'll find out when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. When you're not feeling good and you go to the doctor, what are you hoping to get from your visit? You probably want to get well, of course, but does it matter whether your doctor really seems to care about your well-being? Well, actually, there are reports that show it does. At the University of Wisconsin, a 2011 study of patients who turned out to have the common cold showed that patients who gave their clinician perfect marks for empathy recovered faster and had less severe symptoms than those who didn't. But doctors are people, too, and even as symptoms and test results play a role in how they treat patients, so too do emotions. Dr. Danielle Ofri has taken a close look at emotions in medicine in her work at New York's Bellevue Hospital, her occasional contributions in the New York Times, and in her latest book, What Doctors Feel. She was in Milwaukee recently to give the annual Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She stopped by the Lake Effect studio then and told Mitch Tyke that wanting to help others is related to having empathy, but it's not necessarily the same thing.
When we think about empathy, we think about, I think, the standard definition of can you be in someone else's shoes and look through their eyes? And in medicine specifically is can a physician or a nurse really feel how the patient is suffering? And really that the origin of the words comes from sensing someone's suffering.
Well, and is it just the health issues themselves, or is there something about understanding the weight, if you will, of the medical system around them as a patient comes in the door?
Well, everyone's illness is unique, and partly because everyone's life is unique. And so how one person's pneumonia affects their life is completely different from another person's. If you imagine a healthy 36-year-old soccer player has pneumonia, out 2 days back playing soccer, an elderly widow living alone with pneumonia might send them to a nursing home. And so it completely changes their life, yet it's the same disease.
So do you think is empathy something that ought to be taught in medical school, or is it a question of recognizing it and having it reinforced?
It's an interesting concept. It's one of those things you would think is a little hard to teach. I think that we do a very good job of selecting the right medical students. I'm honestly, in all my years of working with students, I can count on one hand the number of people who didn't really have what it takes to be a good and empathic doctor. However, when we finish training them at the other end, we know from a lot of research that their empathy is at the minimum sorely tested, if not really, you know, eroded. And so something about our training, I think, is affecting that. And so our efforts, not so much to teach empathy, but to preserve it and to model how important it remains in medical care today.
I wonder if there's something to the idea of students and young doctors being able to even simply recognize it as they're feeling it.
Well, partly, I mean, when you're thrown into the medical world, it's like being tossed into Mars without an instruction manual. It's very disorienting. The language is different. The way of dressing, the ethics, everything is different. And students who are keen observers, they watch how their superiors behave, how they walk, how they talk, how they address patients, how they address nurses, and all these things are picked up on. We often call this the hidden curriculum. So there's the explicit curriculum they learn about in the classroom, compassion, empathy, professionalism, and then there's what they see, how medicine is actually practiced in the field, and it's often quite different.
Right. You write at length about your own personal experiences having worked in labs and gone through classroom settings, and then when you're actually confronted with patients that are far different than anything you would have read about in just a textbook, it's a different story altogether.
It's absolutely different story, and I think we're just not prepared, and students aren't so prepared. Patients don't read the book either, and they bring their lives to their illness, and it's really you know, it's up to us to figure that out. And so when I look at who were the role models, they're the ones who in their practice would demonstrate empathy, to take the time to listen, to genuinely care. And those were the doctors who were different than the ones who were brusque and short-tempered, and you kind of know it when you see it.
Well, right. One of the really interesting personal examples you relate is that some of the most important lessons you received about meeting patients on their own terms came from doctors that we might have thought of as old-fashioned. But you write they exhibited something called clinical curiosity. What is that term getting at?
You know, so most of my attendings were these starched white men in starched white coats and bow ties, and their white coats always buttoned all the way up. And our patients at a place like Bellevue, which is a public hospital, were largely immigrants, uninsured people, homeless people. And I always wondered, how will they ever connect? As we brought our attendings to the bedside, I couldn't imagine how this, you know, alcoholic, undocumented Honduran immigrant will relate to this, you know, gray-haired white guy with a bow tie. Yet, these doctors were very patient. They very much wanted to know what was going on with the patient. And they asked many questions. They did thorough physical exams. They were interested. And that interest in itself was a form of empathy and respect. And the patients got it. And they worshiped these doctors. They really felt these doctors cared about them, and they did. And so they didn't need to share the same characteristics. And these doctors didn't need to have been in the Peace Corps or backpacked in Nepal, but they were just interested in their patients, and patients pick up on that.
I wonder if, you know, I think about I have two fairly young kids, and they see doctors at kind of the rate that most children see doctors. And I think of all the pediatricians they've been in touch with, and it feels like there's some built-in empathy that comes with being a pediatrician. And maybe it's not built in, but I wonder if there's something to the idea that pediatricians don't necessarily come into a patient interaction feeling like their patients have made poor personal choices.
Well, one of the lovely things about pediatrics, which I really appreciated more as a parent than I did as a medical student rotating in pediatrics, is that, you know, kids, by and large, you know, they call it like it is. There's not a lot of premeditation. There's not much lying. It is what it is. And there's something really beautiful about that. Though when they actually study empathy, and there are scales that measure empathy, students who score higher on these empathy scales tend to go into primary care fields like pediatrics, obstetrics, internal medicine, family medicine, because they enjoy being with people. That connection gives them a lot of pleasure.
Where does humor come in? There's a lot of humor that you write about that doctors would probably find familiar and that patients might be a little aghast to learn about. But is it possible to have both empathy but also possess this kind of gallows humor that goes along with it?
You know, humor is one of those strange beasts. I mean, it's everywhere in medicine. And we all think, oh, this is so inappropriate. Yet I once worked with an attending in the intensive care unit who was from Tennessee, was also Jewish. If you can imagine kind of that Brooklyn humor, dryness, and Tennessee drawl combined together, who was always making jokes and often at the expense of the patients. And I once confronted him and he said, you know, everyone is dying here. What can you do but laugh? And I got his point, although at times it was awkward. I think that for many of us, humor is a way to handle situations that are very difficult. And as an attending now, as a senior doctor, I try to be very careful when I hear my team joking when it's not appropriate, but to recognize that the humor is a signal for something big, something uncomfortable. We're in that. We need to see what that is.
You also write, though, that people almost universally in the medical field attempt to compartmentalize what they're going through, and that almost universally it doesn't work so well.
No, it doesn't at all. And I think we use that as a coping mechanism. And to some degree, we need to be able to have some separation. I mean, often when you're with the patient, isn't the time for your own emotions to come spilling in. But if you don't attend to those emotions at some point, they will come out. A wonderful study of oncologists looked at the impact of grief. I mean, oncologists, their patients die at a higher rate than most of us. And they did try to compartmentalize, and universally it was a failure, that they would speak about grief would, you know, follow them like a shadow. It would creep into their home life, their work life. It affected how they saw the next patients, and that it was a very real part of their lives. And they had to kind of negotiate an armistice with their grief. They had to face it, find a spot for it, but they couldn't ignore it.
Right. I think there's at least one medical center that you write about that that requires young oncologists in particular to go through, I guess these are sort of stress management seminars.
Well, this is in Rochester where they have the oncology fellows meet weekly to talk about what's happened this week. And part of it is acknowledging all the patients who have died, saying their name, saying a word or two about them. And it's open to anyone, the secretaries, the, you know, the X-ray guys, if they want to come. But it's required for the oncologist to recognize that, you know, this is a very emotional field and you must have at least a spot to say, I have to acknowledge that, boy, it was a really sad week or a horrible week or a frustrating week. And here are the people who I've lost.
You also point out, though, that it is difficult to definitively quantify how this dynamic affects outcomes, whether it cures more illness or manages more illness, say. At the end of the day, why do you think it matters?
Well, one of the things – and I come from a background of science. My PhD is in biochemistry, so I'm very much attuned to and respect hard numbers. But just because we can't quantify it doesn't mean it shouldn't be important. There are many things in life we can't quantify. At some point we say – this is important. I mean, listen, when you feel sick and you go Google your symptoms, you could probably come up with a correct diagnosis, but it's hard to imagine that you'd feel taken care of. And I think most of us, when we're sick, want to be taken care of by real nurses and actual doctors, not by a computer. And that difference between your medical cure and being taken care of, being healed, it's hard to quantify that, but we all know the difference. And we want to be taken care of when we're sick.
You're right, obviously, from the perspective of a doctor, but, you know, obviously you are a person that's also seen by doctors. And I wonder if most of us who are in the position of just being seen by doctors would be well served to have some thoughts about empathy in mind when they walk in the door of the exam room, not to necessarily empathize with the poor, overworked resident. But is there some role for the patient to play?
I think so. I think that when patients come in, they will get a quick intuitive sense if things are going well or things are not going well, even if they can't put their finger on why. And very often when things are not going well, it has to do with the doctor's emotional state, whether they're overworked, frustrated, whether they've been humiliated by their supervisors. And that directly affects patient care. And I think patients being attuned to that, they may not often have the position or power to change that, but they can be aware that something's going on and not to ignore that gut feeling. And if they feel strong enough, they can say, hey, doc, something's up. Or they can talk to a practice manager, or maybe it's time to switch doctors. But there's no reason to settle for a doctor who's an excellent technician but has poor communication or relating skills. There are enough doctors out there who possess both that we shouldn't have to settle for someone with a bedside manner that rivals a roll of surgical tape.
Well, at the same time, you recently wrote a column in the New York Times in which you consider really just how much it's appropriate to share with your patients, the fine line between empathy and getting in the way by oversharing.
Interestingly, you know, doctors often will share, oh, I had a colonoscopy too, so I know how it feels, or, you know, my father had that cancer. And I think we view it as a way to empathize and connect with our patients. But when these patients were studied, most of them found it actually rather intrusive. And I think finding the line of when you are helpful and when you're actually just expressing your, you know, your own needs and issues. And I think we have to really look at the patient, you know, needs first. And sometimes a little bit of sharing is helpful. But in general, if it hogs the spotlight, it becomes detrimental.
Danielle Ofri, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It's a pleasure.
Dr. Danielle Ofri's latest book is called What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. She's an associate professor of medicine at New York University. She practices at Bellevue Hospital in New York and is an occasional contributor to the Well blog for the New York Times. She spoke to us when she was in Milwaukee to give the Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin last fall, and our interview with her first aired in December. We'll take one last break and then talk with the director of a Milwaukee-area group that wants to attract girls and women to technology fields. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Good to have you with us. Recent data from the National Science Foundation shows that women receive just more than half of all undergraduate degrees awarded in STEM subjects. That's science, technology, engineering, and math. But there are still significant gaps in areas such as computer sciences and in engineering itself, in which women represented only 18% of all degree recipients. A local organization is trying to change that. Beth Ackerland is managing director of the group Girls in Tech Milwaukee Chapter. Last summer, she told Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke what her ultimate hope for the organization is.
So I think there are a lot of women working currently in Milwaukee, southeastern Wisconsin, in technology fields. I also think, you know, there isn't necessarily a platform for them to come together and learn from each other. And I think there isn't a lot of women out there or younger girls who know about tech careers or skills. So our ultimate goal is to expose those and grow education and grow skills and knowledge surrounding that space.
Well, and what's the age range you're concentrating on? Because it sounds like you have at one level people you're trying to get interested in these fields mm-hmm. altogether, and then at the other end of the spectrum, people who are already interested, making them more comfortable in these fields.
Right. It's all ages. I mean, I think it starts very young, middle school age, even before then. I mean, you have kids playing with iPads or what have you. That's just the world we live in these days, is very technology focused. It could be someone who just wants a career change and they don't know the skills they need. They don't know what jobs are out there. So it's a variety of ages. And I think technology is for everyone.
Well, what's the approach you're taking?
So what we want to do is, for people who are already in technology, is have that platform to be able to kind of peer mentor with each other and learn about what each other does. I think that helps facilitate education and grow skills. I also think talking to schools or partnering with, you know, younger organizations, let's say Girl Scouts, and just kind of partnering with them and working towards getting that knowledge out there and that awareness of the available jobs or the education that they can get.
Is Girls in Tech a group that, I mean, do you have meetings? How do you bring people into the fold?
Right. So Girls in Tech is a global organization, and it's started in 2007. It's a nonprofit, and there are about 32 chapters worldwide. Each chapter can really cater to the market it's in. So there's a San Francisco, there's one in Chile. So it's really based on what that market, so let's say Milwaukee, is in need of.
Well, and we hear a lot about mentoring and how important it mm-hmm. is to get people comfortable in particular roles. How does it work? I mean, how do you see a good, you know, what do you see a good mentor doing?
I think a good mentor is just very open and honest about what they're doing. I think, you know, peer mentors, you just by talking and helping each other, you know, something that might be difficult, how did you overcome that? Or this skill I want to develop, how can I go about doing that? And learning from experiences is really what peer mentoring is about, and sharing those experiences. So that's our goal, is just build those relationships with each other and learn from each other based on our experiences or paths we've taken to get where we are.
Why are you so passionate about this? So what made that you are in a technical career?
Yeah.
What made the difference for you?
I think I had a lot of great leaders and mentors along the way. I mean, I was an economics major. I always had an interest in technology, but didn't really know how to get there. So kind of each step of the way, just sharing experiences or asking questions and having coworkers, colleagues, bosses, other leaders in my life, just answering those questions and providing their input, just kind of led me down the path. So I think that's what Girls in Tech is really trying to do as well, is just facilitate those conversations and mentoring opportunities to help people grow in those careers or expand their interests.
Did you have any gender challenges, for lack of a better term? I mean, did gender come into it when you were coming along?
Going into stats, there's about 56% of U.S. occupations that are held by women. Only 20% of technology careers are held by women. I think we need to change the perception of what tech careers are. It encompasses so much more than just kind of tech. It's not just programming, engineering, computer science, product marketing, design, entrepreneurship. There's so much that goes into it. I don't think that's exposed. So I think kind of that perception of it being more unattractive is what we're trying to break down, and just get an understanding of that this is a really fun space, and women and young girls should be attracted to it. It's a great, great opportunity. There's a demand there for jobs.
What led to the launch of this chapter?
So much buzz around innovation. Everyone's embracing technology. And I think when we started, two other women helped launch this, Kirsten Corbell and Cindy Thomas from Translator. we kind of got together and said, I think there's a need for this. Let's put it out there. So we got over 50 attendees, and we kind of just had a conversation about what does Milwaukee need? What can we provide? How can we help in these areas for girls in tech?
How, aside from appearing on radio shows, how are you reaching out? How are you casting your net for people who are the right fit for you?
So we have a Facebook group, Girls in Tech Milwaukee, a meetup group. We are doing a lot of word of mouth, social media. We have two sponsors, Centaire and Translator, who have helped us kind of get off our feet. And kind of from here, we are reaching out via email and via those channels with starting some committees. So we want to get people on board who has interest in youth outreach, peer mentoring education, marketing, membership and sponsorship, and just getting people engaged that way in how we can branch out.
Well, Beth Ackerland, thanks so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Beth Ackerland is managing director of the Milwaukee chapter of Girls in Tech and an agile product owner at a company called Centaur in Brookfield. You'll find a link to more about Girls in Tech from WUWM.com/Lake Effect, and our interview with her first aired last summer. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. Stay warm and be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.